Welcome to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We're broadcasting from the UC Irvine campus and streaming live at kuci.org. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and today my guest is Jean Han Korelitz. Jean is the author of the novels You Should Have Known, which aired on HBO in October 2020 as The Undoing, starring Nicole Kidman, Hugh Grant, and Donald Sutherland. Admission, adapted as a film in 2013, starring Tina Fey. The Devil in Webster, The White Rose, The Sabbath Day River, and A Jury of Her Peers, as well as Interference Powder, a novel for children. Her company, Book the Writer, hosts pop-up book groups in which small groups of readers discuss new books with their authors. She lives in New York City with her husband, Irish poet Paul Muldoon. Jean is with me today via Zoom to talk about her new novel, The Plot, published by Celadon Books, a division of Macmillan. Hi, Jean.
Hi, Barbara. Nice to talk to you.
Great to have you back on the show. Your new book, The Plot, is so my kind of book. I love novels with writers as protagonists. And I wonder if you'd tell our listeners a bit about the book and how the story came about.
Oh, sure. Well, first of all, I just want to say it's really great to hear that, because when I was contemplating this story, that, you know, the conventional wisdom was nobody likes to read about a writer. And I thought, well, I like to read about writers, but, you know, but I am one. So, you know, embarking on the project, there was always this great concern that I would finish and people would say, I don't like to read about writers. And yet I'm finding that to be absolutely untrue. Just the early response online and the word of mouth is that, oh, I love books about writers. So obviously the conventional wisdom is incorrect on this score.
Well, I was going to ask you about that. And maybe just for a second, let's talk about that before we actually talk about the book, because that was going to be my next question. I've heard agents say no one wants to read about writers. And where does that even come from?
I have no idea. I mean, there are plenty of things I don't like to read about. I mean, I don't like to read about cars and I don't like to read about sports. But I don't know. I mean, maybe it's just such a mystery about, you know, why we're interested in the, you sort of peer in behind the curtain of how books get made. Well, one of the weird things about writing in general is that people don't think of writing as something that should be hard, because we all use language all the time. You know, you go to the drive-thru and you're using language. How hard can it be to just basically talk, you know, and write it down for a few hundred pages? it is, there's more to it than that. And, you know, there is some deeper thing that's going on when a book gets made, especially a novel.
Anyway, yeah, I love books with novels, with writers as characters, as protagonists. And I wish they would stop saying that.
Well, maybe this, hopefully this will be the book that gives the lie to this conventional wisdom once and for all.
Anyway, tell us about where the story came from.
The story really came out of nowhere. And you know, I've written novels that literally took 20 years to get from idea to the first word on a page. This shared its kind of method of origin with only one of my previous novels, You Should Have Known, which became The Undoing, in that it was nowhere and then it was there, out of nowhere, in my head. And but the really interesting thing about this book is that I was writing a different book. And in fact, I was in the middle of a very unpleasant meeting in my editor's office in which she was explaining to me, not for the first time, that she was not buying the book that I thought was finished and ready to be bought. But that, you know, she would eventually, but that it was not ready yet. And I had to do another draft. And I was very fed up with this book that I've been working on for years and sort of full of despair. And then suddenly I heard myself say to her, well, you know, I have this other idea. And I kind of upchucked this whole idea in her office. And by the end of the meeting, I was basically had agreed to put aside the other novel and write this. And then the pandemic started. So I found myself in a very isolated house in upstate New York, really, really reluctant to watch the news or pay attention to what was happening in the world because I was so upset about it and so scared and so furious at, you know, people who will not be named about the ways in which this pandemic was so much worse than it had to be. And I was just in the grip of a compulsion to write every day. And I finished the novel in about 4 months, which is insane. But it was 4 months of the most intense work that I think I'd ever experienced.
That, you know, it's interesting to hear you talk about projects that take a long time. You know, you said you've worked on books that took 20 years to get from idea to book. Mm-hmm. And I'm curious what sustains you through that time. And if that's sort of a, you know, a start and stop thing or what?
No, it's more of an incubation. I mean, I think from the minute you write that first sentence, you have a responsibility to finish the book. Doesn't mean I've always managed it, but it's a personal failure if you do not finish a book that you have started, for me. The novel I'm thinking of that took 20 years was, well, there were two. It was The Sabbath Day River and The White Rose. Both came out of preoccupations and questions that I had first had 20 years before I began to write the books. It's a mystery to me, but all I can say is that sometimes an idea will just work at you and not let you go until you have done right by it, which is actually something that I write about in the plot.
Yes, you do. So let's talk specifically about this book, because Jake is a writing instructor who's sick of reading his students' work. And, you know, he believes no one is talented. And then this one student comes along who sort of changes his view. And
he's the worst possible student because I haven't done a lot of teaching. I'm not a gifted teacher, but I've done enough to know that in every class there is somebody like this. And it's usually a guy. And he sits there in his chair and he crosses his arms over his chest and he gives you this look that basically says, who the hell do you think you are? And what makes you think you have a thing to teach me? And, you know, teachers of creative writing know this guy. They can point to him in every class. And this is the student who, unfortunately for Jake, who is our protagonist and a bit of a failed writer, this guy has an absolutely brilliant idea for a book. An idea so brilliant that he probably can't mess it up by writing badly, but in fact, he's not even a bad writer. So it's like, you know, it's like the bully who kicks sand in your face on the beach, who is gonna get the girl and is gonna get the Heisman Trophy and is gonna be a senator and is gonna run for president. You know, there's no stopping this horrible, horrible student and his brilliant idea.
And then, of course, it takes place at a low-res program that reminded me of the college I went to. I went to Goddard.
Oh, you are kidding. That's hilarious. My mother went to Goddard when it was a real, you know, a conventional college. Went to see it. I went to see Goddard some years ago. I was in northern Vermont, and I was near Goddard, and I went to drive through the campus. And frankly, Goddard was in my mind when I wrote those chapters, Ripley. So good for you. You got it absolutely right.
Interesting. I'm like, wait a minute. It's sort of the northeast part of Vermont. Wait a minute. It can't be Bennington.
Yeah. No, I don't want to completely diss writing programs. It is true that I did not get an MFA, but I have dear friends who got them and loved them and learned from them. I realize that some of the chapters about the MFA program take some humor at the expense of the teachers and the students, but you know, I just had to do it. So,
well, I find it encouraging that you didn't get an MFA.
Oh,
I don't know. I mean, more and more, so many of my favorite authors do not have MFAs, and that's always encouraging because there's such a pressure, I think, on writers to, you know, consider getting an MFA, or if they don't get an MFA, they're not going to get published. And so it's always inspiring when it happens.
Well, it's a good thing I either didn't know that rule or I chose to ignore it. But I mean, I did go to England for a couple of years after I went to college, and I spent 2 years in an academic program, even knowing that I was not going to be an academic. So I'm not, I'm not claiming to be morally superior by any means. I spent those 2 years basically reading novels and writing poetry. So maybe it was my personal MFA.
Yeah, I think so. So you said a few minutes ago that you wrote the plot in 4 months. And so I'm curious, did you have an outline? Did you know where you were going? How did you get through it?
Yeah, it's a hard thing to describe to people who are not themselves writers, but the trick is that there's a sort of a sweet spot between knowing where you're going and not knowing too much. So I knew where the twists were. I didn't know everything that was going to happen. I had questions that had to be answered. I think it's fair to say that I had the big reveals of the novel in my head when I started, but the details about, you know, how things would unfold and the specific things that are going to happen to this hapless protagonist unlucky protagonist along the way, I did not know until I wrote them. So the novel, I don't know if we've even said what it's about, but it's about this failed writer who finds himself teaching in this kind of very marginal, I would say, I'm not talking of Goddard now, but Ripley College, it's called, and it's kind of a MFA program where everybody gets in. It's not hard to get into Ripley College, and Jake is not used to meeting extremely gifted writers at Ripley College, but he needs the income because his own literary career is really in the toilet. He meets this arrogant, horrible jerk-off guy who has this brilliant plot, and he's somewhat in despair because some people don't deserve the kind of success that this guy's going to get. But you know, those are the rules. It's his idea. He's writing his book, and a few years later, when he discovers that this student has died and died shortly after their encounter, and has not written his book, certainly not published his book, he has a kind of crisis about what his responsibilities are. And he decides that his responsibility at this point is to the story, because he is a writer and this is a story that needs to be told. So he writes the book. He does not steal a word from the very small excerpt that he even remembers seeing. He does not steal a detail. He steals the story in the same way that James Joyce, quote unquote, steals Ulysses from Homer. I mean, this is something that writers do, that artists do. It's, you know, works of art are in conversation with other works of art. This is part of the joy of storytelling. And when he finds this immense success because of this book that he writes, he also, unfortunately, summons up some person who seems to know what he did and who is very, 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 very unhappy about it. Because as it transpires, the student, the dead student himself, has stolen this story. And it's the person he stole it from who is so enraged and so intent on revenge.
I mean, I consider you a literary writer. When I read your work, it's literary fiction to me. And plot is such a big deal here. And it seems that you just have a knack for plot. And am curious about that, where you learned it, or do you see yourself that way? Or, you know, is it just a natural way of thinking for you? You know, what happens next? No, you know, this has to happen. No, keep the pace going. I mean,
yeah.
Yeah.
I actually can answer this question. I love language, but language without a story to me is not satisfying. Also, a poorly written story is not satisfying. The books that I love the most really need both. As far as plot, I learned a really important lesson from, of all things, I had a distant cousin named Helene Hamp, who wrote
yes.
The Enduring Crossroad. And this is a book that book lovers have always loved. And Helene was a revered writer among book lovers, quite rightly. She also wrote a memoir called Underfoot in Show Business, which was all about her life in and around the theater world in the 1930s, 40s, and 50s. She was in New York trying to be a playwright. She failed. But while she was busy failing at the only thing she'd ever set out to do, she had some amazing experiences. And one of the experiences that she had was writing for the Ellery Queen mystery series on New York, on television in the 1950s. Mm-hmm. And television was a very new medium. It was considered déclassé by her theater friends, and there wasn't a lot of money in it. So the only characters in each of her scripts were Ellery Queen, his father, the murderer, the victim, and one other person. And out of this kind of small handful of possibilities, she had to make murder plots every week. She had to churn them out. And what she discovered was, you know, that being forced into this kind of, these constraints forced her to be very inventive. And she said she learned more from writing these murder plots than she had learned from Stanislavski about how to write, you know, how to make great plays. So if you take the basic lesson that she learned from writing these mysteries, what you understand is that it has to be satisfying, but it also has to be surprising. And you can't cheat. You can't have a new character pop in at the end. You can't have somebody be a split personality. You just have to find a way to make it work. It has to be satisfying because you have to have seen it, but not seen it all the way through. And that sounds even harder than having, you know, an infinity of possible villains. But actually, there's a kind of a discipline there that makes it happen. I mean, I don't really know how else to describe it, but in all of my plot-driven novels, the solution is never far from the protagonist. It's never, you know, a stranger who walks in off the street. And there's always a really good reason why not only this person has done what they've done, but why they are in communication with the protagonist. Because at the end of the day, you know, in some way, it's always the protagonist's fault.
Hmm.
So that's my big secret weapon, the Ellery Queen mysteries of the 1950s.
Hmm. And the restraint, because you're talking about restraint, you know, like she had these certain elements that had to be a part of it. And that's what you're talking about, right?
Yeah, you have to somehow make it make sense within the constraints of your characters. You can't just keep adding characters until you find somebody who has a motive. It has to be somehow resonant. I mean, if you want to get super, you know, intellectual at this point, which is never a good move for me, this is also a variation of something that I learned during those 2 years when I was writing poetry and reading novels in a lecture about, of all things, Oedipus Rex, in which I learned that, you know, every great whodunit is about the person saying whodunit. I mean, Oedipus Rex comes out in front of the palace and he says, you know, who's responsible for this? And the answer, as we all know, is you are.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, this is the journey that every protagonist somehow has to make. I mean, it may not involve chariots and babies being put out on the mountainside, but it can't be random. The person who embarks upon the journey to figure it out cannot be some random person unrelated to the crime itself. There is culpability in the best, transformations.
Yeah.
So, I mean, Jake embarks on this thinking that he's got a great plot, and what he discovers is something in which he himself is somehow implicated. That's probably more than I should say. But,
yeah. Yeah. And of course, you write from a male point of view. And
yeah, that's a first for me, except I did it. I had three narrators, three protagonists in The White Rose, and one was a man. But yeah, I didn't even consider making Jake a woman. He's not a terrific guy, but none of my protagonists are especially, sweet, nice people. Mm. I don't seem to be able to make those people.
Well, that's what makes your book so wonderful, I think, is you have these characters who are not, maybe wonderful people, but they have so many different facets of their personalities that make them interesting and make you actually want to root for them, which is...
I'm always amused when I'm not always amused by criticism, but when I get criticism that runs along the lines of, well, I didn't like her, I didn't like him, I always want to say, well, I'm sure they wouldn't like you either. So, but what does that matter?
Right.
Why are you reading a novel to make a friend for life? Because don't, because that's a bad way to make a friend. Make a friend in real life. And, let's frolic in the bad behavior of complicated people.
Well, yeah, some of the most interesting characters are not people you'd ever really want to hang out with, but you love reading about them. We want to be in their world for a little bit.
Absolutely. Yeah.
But I'm also curious if writing from a male point of view is easier in some ways because there's that distance from your gender. It's not you. It can't be you because it's this guy.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, what really concerned me about Jake was not so much his maleness, but his self-flagellation and his feelings of failure and his transgression. I mean, that's something that's not limited to men or women. But maybe, just now that I'm thinking of it, because this isn't a story about appropriation, some part of me thought, well, I'm going to participate in appropriation myself by, writing as a man, appropriating the male gaze, so to speak. I don't know. I mean, it's not something I really thought through beforehand.
Well, I would love to hear you read from the plot.
Well, good. And as I was saying to you before, this is the first time I've read from this book. So I've never read out loud from it, not even to myself. So we're hoping that this is a good excerpt to choose. I guess we'll find out. But this is an excerpt that takes place at a very important moment in the story when Jake, who has just discovered that his former student, whose name is Evan Parker, has died, and that this story, this magnificent story, which, by the way, we don't hear. I mean, the reader gets bits of the story throughout the book, but the reader does not learn what's so interesting about the story until quite far into the book. So this is a sort of about his dark night of the soul when he thinks through what he's going to do now. So stories are maddeningly elusive. There is no deep mine of them to blast around in a big box store with wide aisles of unused, undreamed of, and thrillingly new narratives for a writer to push a big empty shopping cart through, waiting for something to catch their eye. Those seven storylines Jake had once measured against Evan Parker's not very exciting excerpt, Overcoming the Monster, Rags to Riches, Journey and Return, they were the same seven storylines writers and other storytellers have been rummaging around in forever. And yet, every now and then, some magical little spark flew up out of nowhere and landed in the consciousness of a person capable of bringing it to life. This was occasionally called inspiration, though inspiration was not a word writers themselves tended to use. Those magical little sparks tended not to waste time in declaring themselves. They woke you up in the mornings with an annoying tap, tap, and a sense of unfolding urgency, and they hounded you through the days that followed. The idea, the characters, the problem, the setting, lines of dialogue, descriptive phrases, an opening sentence. To Jake, the word that comprised the relationship between a writer and their spark was responsibility. Once you were in possession of an actual idea, you owed it a debt for having chosen you and not some other writer. And you paid that debt by getting down to work, not just as a journeyman fabricator of sentences, but as an unshrinking artist ready to make painful, time-consuming, even self-flagellating mistakes. Rising to this responsibility was a matter of facing your blank page or screen and muzzling the critics inside your head, at least long enough for you to get some work done, all of which was profoundly difficult and none of which was optional. What's more, you stepped away from it at your peril, because if you failed in this grave responsibility, you might well find after some period of distraction or even less than fully committed work that your precious spark had left you. Gone, in other words, as suddenly and unexpectedly as it had appeared, and your novel along with it. Though you might spin your wheels for a few months or a few years or the rest of your life, hopelessly throwing words onto the page and a stubborn refusal to face what had happened. And then there was something else, an extra dark superstition for any writer hubristic enough to ignore the spark of a great idea. Even if that writer was not of a religious bent, even if he did not believe that everything happens for a reason, even if indeed he resisted magical thinking of every other conceivable kind, the superstition held that if you did not do right by the magnificent idea that had chosen you among all possible writers to bring to life, that great idea didn't just leave you to spin your stupid and ineffectual wheels, it actually went to somebody else. A great story, in other words, wanted to be told. And if you weren't going to tell it, it was out of here. It was going to find another writer who would, and you would be reduced to watching somebody else write and publish your book. Intolerable. Jake remembered the day a certain key moment in his first novel had suddenly been there with him in the world. No preamble, no warning. And despite the fact that this had never happened to him before, his very first thought in the instant that followed its appearance had been, grab it. And he had. And he had done right by that spark and written the best novel he could around it, the new and noteworthy first book that had turned so fleetingly the attention of the literary world in his direction. He lacked even a pallid little frisson of an idea with his second novel, though obviously he had finished that book limping along to some point at which he was permitted to write the words, the end. It had been the end, all right, to his period of promise as a young writer to watch. And it might have been wiser not to publish it at all, but Jake had been terrified to lose the validation of The Invention of Wonder, his first novel. After each and every one of the legacy publishers and then an entire tranche of university presses had rejected the manuscript, the importance of publishing his second book had swelled until his entire being seemed to be on the line. If he could only get this one idea out of the way, he told himself at the time, maybe the next idea, the next spark would come. Only it hadn't. And while he continued to have the occasional crusty and serviceable idea in the years since, there had been nothing tapping away at him, compelling him to write. The work he'd done since then on these and a couple of even worse ideas had petered out. Until, if he was being completely honest with himself, and just now he was being completely honest with himself, he'd stopped even trying. It had been more than 2 years since Jake had written a word of fiction. Once long ago, he had done his best to honor what he'd been given. He'd recognized his spark and done right by it, never shirking the hard work and the careful writing, pushing himself to do well and then to do better. He had taken no shortcuts and evaded no effort. He had taken his chance against the world, submitting himself to the opinions of publishers, reviewers, and ordinary readers. The favor had passed over him and moved on to others. What was he to do? Who was he to be if no other spark ever came to him again? It was unbearable to contemplate. good writers borrow, great writers steal, Jake was thinking. That ubiquitous phrase was attributed to T.S. Eliot, which didn't mean Eliot himself hadn't stolen it. But Eliot had been talking, perhaps less than seriously, about the theft of actual language, phrases and sentences and paragraphs, not of a story itself. Besides, Jake knew, as Eliot had known, as all writers ought to know, that every story, like every single work of art, from the cave paintings to whatever was playing at the Park Theater in Cobbleskill to his own puny books, was in conversation with every other work of art, bouncing against its predecessors, drawing from its contemporaries, harmonizing with the patterns. All of it, paintings and choreography and poetry and photography and performance art and the ever-fluctuating novel, was whirling away in an unstoppable spin art machine of its own. And that was a beautiful, thrilling thing. He would hardly be the first to take some tale from a play or a book, in this case, a book that had never been written, and create something entirely new from it. Miss Saigon from Madame Butterfly, The Hours from Mrs. Dalloway, The Lion King from Hamlet, for goodness sake. It wasn't even taboo, and obviously it wasn't theft, even if Parker's manuscript actually existed at the time of his death. Jake had never seen more than a couple of pages of the thing, and he remembered little of what he had seen. These then were the circumstances in which Jake found himself that January evening at his computer, in his cruddy Cobleskill apartment in the leather stocking region of upstate New York, out of pride, hope, time, and he could finally admit ideas of his own. He hadn't gone looking for this. He had upheld the honor of writers who listened to the ideas of other writers and then turned responsibly back to their own. He had absolutely not invited the brilliant spark his student had abandoned, okay, involuntarily abandoned, to come to him. But come it had, and here it was, this urgent, shimmering thing, already tapping in his hand, in his head, already hounding him, the idea, the characters, the problem. So what was Jake going to do about that? A rhetorical question, obviously. He knew exactly what he was going to do about that.
Thank you so much. That was Jean Hamp Korelitz reading from The Plot, published by Celadon. Wow. Yeah, I love that section. And, you know, it says so much about Ham goes into his sort of rationale for what he does, which made sense to me.
Well, you know, it makes sense to writers because we know that we are all dipping into the same, you know, subterranean river of ideas. And to sort of put your foot down and say, you know, nobody can take what I'm writing and, you know, make something else out of it is to sort of miss the point of what an, you know, inspiration, quote unquote, is. But it's worth reiterating that this is not about copying language. Mm-hmm. You know, to plagiarize language is to be the lowest of low. You know, you should be drawn and quartered if you copy language from another writer. You know, careers are ruined justly by plagiarism. But this is not plagiarism. This is something else.
Yeah, and ideas cannot be copywritten, right? So,
and we would all be poorer if they could. I mean, just imagine one writer owning Boy Meets Girl, Boy Loses Girl, Boy Gets Girl again. I mean, think of all the books that would not have been written and the movies that would not have been made. You know, that's not a world we want to live in, whether we realize it or not.
Mm. Well, I noticed throughout there's a nod to Patricia Highsmith with, you know, Ripley's the name of the school. Talented Tom is the name of the person who's writing the emails to him. Do you like Patricia Highsmith or has she been an influence?
You know, I've read the Ripley novels. I've read a couple of the other books. I'm not an aficionado necessarily, but I've read some biographies. She was really a piece of work, Patricia Highsmith. I don't know that I would have enjoyed going out to lunch with her, but she really made an indelible character in Ripley. And he just is well, he's not one of a kind, but he's, there aren't many like Ripley, thank goodness.
And you said before you read that you don't read your work out loud.
I should, obviously. I noticed a couple of things just in that section that I wish I'd read out loud. I would have noted that I'd used the same word twice within two sentences, and I would have wanted to fix that, but that's life.
But yet, well, I didn't notice that actually, but you know, the dialogue works, so everything really works so well. And how do you, when you're revising, how do you have enough distance from your work to be able to see it, to revise, you know?
I don't know that distance is the operative, you know, skill. I think everything that's on the page really has to earn its place there. Nothing horrifies me more than kind of fluff. Language that's just taking up space and doesn't serve the book at all. So I have learned to be quite ruthless about those things. More and more gets cut each time. That's actually something I learned from my first novel, well, which of course was not my first novel, it was my third novel, but my first to be published. And I was so happy to, you know, obviously to have a book published and to finally have an editor. I turned up for my first editorial meeting, you know, completely compliant and ready to do whatever this woman told me to do. And I remember the first thing she said was, cut 100 pages. And I sort of went, what? And I said, okay, I'm gonna cut 100 pages, why? And I thought there was some kind of big editorial magic secret that she was about to impart to me. And what she said was, it's 100 pages too long. And I managed to do this by going through every single paragraph of this novel and realizing that every paragraph had something that could go, so an extraneous sentence, the little fluff inside of a sentence. And I thought, as just as an experiment, I would cut all of that stuff and see how much that ended up being. And it was 70 pages. 70 pages of that novel, you know, hit the floor because it didn't do anything. Mm. And then the other 30 pages I achieved by creative reformatting. Shh. I never explained that to her. I reprinted a smaller font and slightly wider margin. I guess she didn't notice, but the lesson was learned. You know, your deathless prose, you know, just is not all equally deathless. It can be trimmed.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I'm also curious about the novel that Jake wrote is excerpted throughout the plot. Talk about that, the choice in doing that.
Yeah, well, it was not my choice. My choice was not to do it because it was hard. And I was hoping to avoid the work of having to do it. And in the middle of writing it, I actually listened to an interview with Lily King, who had also just published a novel called Writers mm-hmm. and Lovers about mm-hmm. a writer, in which she does not provide samples of this great novel that her protagonist is writing. And somebody asked her, you know, why did you decide not to do it? And she said, well, I realized that, you know, nothing I could ever write would be as good as the implication of how good this book was. So I just didn't do it. And I thought, oh, good. I don't have to do it either. I'm sitting up here in the middle of writing this book and thinking, oh, terrific. You know, Lily King didn't do it, so I don't have to do it either. Unfortunately, my editor said to me, you got to do it. And she was right. In this case, I mean, maybe not for Lily King, but because the excerpts of Jake's novel, which appear throughout the plot, you know, they converge with Jake's story, and they also combine with what he's discovering in the world, you know, in his own investigation, to reveal, you know, what's so spectacular about this plot that somebody is willing to go to the lengths that they're willing to go to. So yes, I had to do it, and you know, it becomes part of the revelation about what's going on here. What's in
yeah,
this-
Yeah. So you had your draft of the novel and your editor said, okay, now write that. And we're
pretty much, yeah. I mean, I had done a couple of chapters and then I heard the Lily King interview and I thought, I'm just going to put this aside. And I submitted it to her without them. And she said, nah, yeah, you're not off the hook. You got to write. And of course, she was right.
Interesting. Okay. So one thing that was fun for me in reading this is that about 200 pages in, I guessed who was writing the emails. Mm-hmm. And then I wasn't sure. Of course, mm-hmm. I wasn't sure. And then it ended up being who I thought it was. And it reminded me of what I've heard. I don't read traditional mysteries, but I've heard from readers who do that part of it is being a part of solving the mystery. And that readers want to know who did it before the characters in the book know. Yeah. And so I was curious if that was on your mind when you were writing the plot.
Yeah, well, you know, we were just talking about this. I was just, before we started talking, I was on a call with my editor and we were having this exact conversation. And I was pointing out that many of the early reviews on Goodreads have mentioned, I figured out this part of the mystery, but it didn't detract from my enjoyment of the book. And I think that in itself is quite interesting. Yes, you know, we're proud to know who it is before this protagonist is, but if there were no other surprises, I think that would be considered a failure on my part. The other thing is that the mystery of who's doing this to Jake is only one of the big twists in the novel. And nobody so far has said that they figured out, you know, what's so wonderful about this plot that it has created this disastrous situation for the author. Good for these people. They figured it out beforehand. Good for you. I probably wouldn't have. I'm also not a big reader of mysteries, but it's not so much the who, it's the why and right. The how.
Right.
So I am content. I'm content with the level of surprise. I got an extremely satisfying text from my daughter as she realized who the person was. She did not figure it out beforehand. She was so shocked that she, I got a kind of real-time text with many, many, many exclamation marks. And I was very gratified by that. So I'm okay with you got it beforehand, as long as it does not take away from your pleasure and enjoyment in the story. And I'm also okay with the exclamation marks.
You know, I enjoyed it more, I think, because I thought I knew. And I found that really interesting. It's like, okay, let's see how this unfolds. And so it actually added to my enjoyment, I think, of the story, because then, you know, it's complicated. It's complicated. Yeah. So I just found it really interesting. I kind of felt good about myself too, that I had an idea who it was, you know? I mean, it was just an interesting experience because there was a lot going on here.
Well, remember, I mean, it's the Ellery Queen mysteries. You know, they're right. Only five characters. You know, it's the murderer, it's the corpse, it's Ellery and his father and one other person. So if I had gone outside of that, you might have been disappointed by that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but it, yeah, no, I totally loved it. So I'm curious if you grew up in a literary household. I mean, Helene Hanf was your cousin, and was there a lot of literary conversation around the dinner table and lots of books in the house and all that? No,
I actually didn't meet Helene till I was about 16. I was bemoaning the fact that I came from such a non-literary family, and my mother said, well, you have this cousin. And I looked her up. She wasn't hard to find because Helene's address actually appears in most of her books. So, and that is so that her fans can reach her. And she used to get many letters, you know, every day from all over the world, people writing to the address in her books. And, you know, it meant so much to her after decades of struggle to have this kind of late life, fame and accomplishment. But I wrote to her and I went to see her. She was lived on the Upper East Side. She lived in a building that after her death renamed itself Charing Cross House in her honor. So if you go over there, I believe it's 305 East 72nd Street. There's a beautiful plaque outside the entry that talks about Helene. And whenever I'm in the neighborhood, I go over there and just look at it. But it was not a particularly literary house. There were books. Both my parents read. They read novels. My dad reads a lot of history as well. But he was a doctor, and my mom was a therapist. So there were certainly conversations about, you know, those fields, and very significantly for You Should Have Known, which was about a marriage therapist. There were a lot of conversations about some of the mistakes that people make in their lives that bring them to therapy. But there were not literary conversations. That's something I kind of found my way to on my own.
When I got to the end of the book, I'm certainly not going to talk about the ending, but it struck me as maybe being sort of literary noir, because of the ending. And we can't really talk about the ending, but yeah, I guess what I'm trying to say is, what do you want to leave the reader with at the end of the book? Or at the end of any book, really, at the end of any novel? Are you, you know, is there a certain something you're hoping the reader takes away?
I think, of course, I'm playing with this notion that goes back to the beginning of the book, where this low residency MFA program, their motto or their unofficial motto is anybody can be a writer, which is something we writers find amusing. Because I can't be a ballet dancer, even though I take ballet twice a week. I can't be a painter. I can't be a lawyer at this point in my life. There are many things I can't be. And guess what? Not everybody can be a writer either. But it's the ending of the novel returns to this notion of who gets to be a writer. So it doesn't stop playing with some of these ideas until the very last page. And I hope people enjoy the ending. They seem to be enjoying it a lot. And woe to the person who gives it away, because I will come down on that person like a ton of bricks.
You mentioned Goodreads. Do you read reviews? Are you interested in what people are saying?
I'm reading them now because they're so good. And I'm very, very happy to read them. I'm used to mixed reviews. I mean, the mixed review has been my lot in life since, you know, the very first novel. And I'm also used to readers not liking my characters and not liking my writing. You know, some people will say in a review, this is my fourth novel by Jean Corlitz, and I just hate her writing. And I just want to say, please stop reading my work. It's not going to change. You know, this is how I write. And I love complicated protagonists, and you're probably not going to get super nice people. You know, please save yourself. Stop reading my work. but at the moment, I mean, I was, of course, as the early galleys started to go out to Goodreads readers, I was concerned. I was anticipating, you know, what the response would be. And it has been so gratifying. I think people aren't complaining about Jake, even though, you know, there's plenty to complain about. They're not complaining about my writing too much, a little bit, not too much. And even the ones, as we were saying earlier, who figure it out or figure part of it out, they almost inevitably, the next line of the review is, but it didn't detract. I mean, I still loved kind of seeing how it all worked out. And that, you know, I feel incredibly happy with that. That's exactly where I think any writer would love to be on the eve of their book's publication.
Yeah. Well, you know, Jake, again, as cynical as he is, he's quite empathetic. I don't know. I mean, what's not to like, you know? I mean, really, I mean, maybe I could see him being difficult, you know, having him as my instructor maybe, but I don't know.
He has been through, you know, the fiery furnace of failure, and he is grateful for the success that he achieves, but he is never without guilt and fear because of what he's done. He knows that, you know, as a writer, he has betrayed no one. In fact, he has been, he has honored, you know, the spark as described in that excerpt, but he also knows how what he's done will appear to everybody else. And he knows that his career, his sense of self-worth, you know, all the people whose livelihoods are now caught up in his, people he's working with, his publisher, that he's going to lose all of their regard as well if this gets out. So he's a kind of mass of contradiction. He knows that he has not done anything wrong, but he knows that the world won't see it that way.
You said that you wrote it in 4 months and you were just kind of blasting through it. So in those 4 months, did you ever hit a wall? And if so, what do you do when you reach that place where you just, you don't know what comes next, or do you not reach that place? Does that not?
Well, I did hit something. It wasn't a wall. It was, you know, in writing a novel, you're making a series of decisions constantly. You know, you're turning left instead of right. You're bringing in this character. You're making this happen, and any one of those things can be the wrong decision. So it's all terrifying. But at one point, I did make a wrong turn, and I had to go back. I had to sort of unravel about 100 pages of a plot of writing, and I had to put it back together in a different way. That it sort of felt like a wall because I had to stop moving forward and fix what I'd done. But once I had done that, it was straight sailing to the end.
And we have a few minutes left, so I have another question or two. So, and then when you do that, are there other phases of revision? Like once you have, you know, you have what you think is the final draft, you have the novel excerpts embedded within the text, you have your draft, then what?
Well, then it's just, you're going through it again and again and again, and you're refining and you're cutting and you're trimming and you're fixing problems. And then at that point, you really need other people's eyes on it because you're just not seeing it anymore. So that's when, for example, my editor was able to say, you're gonna need those chapters now. You're gonna need those excerpts of Jake's novel. The ones I've been hoping I wouldn't have to write. So, you know, you're just refining and refining. I mean, ironically, that's where I am now in the book that I'm working on now, as I'm like intensely revising. And this is now, I've gone back to the book I was writing before I got this idea for the plot. I have to fix. There's a lot of fixing that needs to be done.
Do you ever leave projects go and just go, you know what? I have 100 pages, but never mind.
I did it once and it was so painful. But it was right before September 11th happened. And after September 11th happened, I let go of this book that wasn't working. And I started to write a novel called The White Rose, which, you know, even all these years later, is an incredibly special novel to me because it's not autobiographical at all, but it's a deeply personal novel. And it's also purposely set before September 11th because I wanted so desperately to go back in time and be in a world in which that thing had not happened. So I let go the book that I was writing. I've never gone back to it. I think it's floating out in deep space, never to be hauled back into the airlock. I think it's best.
Well, it's been a great pleasure talking with you and you know, reading this book, which I love. And now I want to read The White Rose. I haven't read that one, but I'm going to. And
I know we're not supposed to have favorite children, but I have to say The White Rose is my favorite child. I love them all, but The White Rose is special.
How do you keep concentrating? You said you're writing something now. You have all this promo stuff going on for this book. How do you keep it separate?
I don't know that I've been able to do that. Well, I have a deadline, so that's wonderfully conducive to concentration. But I, you know, it's also a job that I have to finish. It's, you know, it's something that, I just need to finish it. It's right. It's a big book. It's very different from the plot, and it's such a challenge to make it work. And I will make it.
Well, I can't wait for that one too. So, thank you so much, Jean, for taking the time.
I can't believe you went to Goddard. That's so.
Oh yes, I went to Goddard a long time ago. Yeah.
It's a strange and unusual place.
Mm-hmm. It is. It was totally right for me at the time. I don't know if I would have made it through any other college or university. So it was totally right for me. But it is interesting.
Well, you were spot on when you read those chapters set at Ripley College and you thought Goddard, because so did I.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Okay.
And you've been listening to Writers on Writing. I've been with Jean Hamp Horowitz. Her book is The Plot, published by Celadon. We'll be right here next week, so tune back in. And all you writers out there, stay in the chair.
From heaven, like I'm not just somebody you've seen.